Aggressive, dominant, excellent, adult onset, prenatal, infertility, pediatrics, cancer, cardiac, neuro. Welcome to Gene Therapy with Nick Charles.
Hello, hello, and welcome back. My name is Nick Charles, and this is Gene Therapy. This is the second part of our two-parter episode with our first special guest, Casey Marks, where we are discussing how to become a genetic counselor and what the world of a genetic counselor looks like from day to day. In this second portion, we talk about what we feel are the most useful tips and tricks and advice for any aspiring genetic counselor. And we go through some tidbits of information and life advice that we wish that we had when we started our journeys. And then we also talk about literally how to become a genetic counselor. And I will say, in editing this two-part episode, I have realized that I use a lot of filler language, such as the word like and and just like little phrases and, you know, American terms of phrase, like, you know, I say, you know, a lot. So I'm gonna try to work on that to improve your listening experience. Not that anybody's complained, but I'm always looking to improve myself and my craft. So there you go. Anywho, I do apologize. It does seem like throughout the second portion of the recording, there's a couple of little glitches and the audio doesn't seem to line up between me and Casey in terms of what we're saying. I have no idea how to fix that because I am a grassroots one-person podcast machine, and Lord knows that means I have no actual training in, you know, sound engineering or things like that. So it's nothing that's going to take away from any of the information that we're discussing or the tomfoolery and ha-has that we have, but maybe it's just me being a type A personality, you know, like we talk about a lot in this two-parter. So in saying that, enjoy part two of our How Do You Become a Genetic Counselor episode with special guest Casey Marks. And before we jump into part two, let's hear a word from our sponsors. Anywho, last question, and then we'll move on. This is on the spot, so don't feel like, oh my God, you have to come up with, like, you know, Beethoven sonatas. But what are your top five tips off the top of your head for individuals thinking about becoming a genetic counselor?
So I have given this some thought. I think that number one, and something I learned very early, is to be flexible and able to adapt. Especially now with what's going on in the world, you never know when things are gonna, you know, the table's gonna get flipped or turned or whatever the expression is. But I think that as an genetic counselor, you have to be flexible. I think as a student, you have to be flexible. And then as a professional, you know, you're not always going to be able to have your full hour long session. Some people only get a half hour session, and you have to adapt to the last minute patients and the unexpected results from genetic testing, and be able to think on your feet and adapt at a moment's notice. So, you know, whether it's your professor telling you that you have three more lectures on a day that you thought you were going to have free to do something else, or, you know, results that you weren't expecting, being flexible is really helpful. or when your last clinical internship just gets canceled because of a worldwide pandemic.
Right, yeah.
You know, be flexible.
Yep. Yeah, this is basically, this is just like all really great training, yeah. For your class for being flexible.
The next thing, yeah, I would say is having an attention to detail. We were talking before with like the Fragile X families, you know, like we can see these patterns in a family history. We know where to look in a patient's medical history for clues. Being a genetic counselor is a lot like being a detective, and like, I love me some true crime. So, that attention to detail, yeah, is going to be helpful, whether it's in your writing, your ability to diagnose a patient, to see the details in someone's body language, to know how to talk to them. That attention to detail, that's why I think there are so many type A personalities in genetic counseling, because we have that attention to detail.
Yes, but also going along those lines, being type A personalities, I think something that we have to swallow as a really hard pill for type A personalities is the only way you're going to get better at being a genetic detective is by having your first experience where you're probably going to think you know what's going on. And then you like fall flat on your face. It's going to happen and it's totally fine. Like, it's unlikely that you are going to be really screwing up somebody's, you know, care plan or care directly. But whatever it is that you fall on your face for, you're never going to do it again because you're a type A personality. And, you know, like also you need like a part of being a good investigator is being able to know, you know, oh, well, I have the experience in blah, 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 so it's probably not that. But like, there's going to be certain things, you know, especially with X-linked disorders, like, oh, we don't have testing on mom, but mom has two affected children. So what does that make her chance to be an obligate carrier and things like that? And like, those are all really valuable detective skills for us, but you don't have them immediately. And a lot of type A personalities don't want to make a mistake and want to feel like they have all the tools they need immediately. But, you know, like in any other part of life, you need to fail first to get back up and be better. So it's going to happen, and don't feel bad about it. I mean, you can feel bad about it for a little while, but then just keep going. And that certainly happened to me, and I'm sure to many other people. Genetic detective is just like really fun.
Honestly,
like, there should be a board game.
Can we like come up with a proposal to change the title genetic counselor to genetic detective?
Oh, I mean, sure. I mean, that would be really fun, like, but also maybe that would be giving the wrong idea of what we, like, oh, this is your genetic detective, you know, Casey, and it's like what are you here to do for me? Like I don't know what's going on. But wouldn't that be like a really fun board game, like Guess Who, but with like conditions?
wait, we need to make this
wait
happen.
A second. Because wouldn't that be an amazing study tool for for boards? Oh, okay.
Trademarked.
Nobody can take this idea. It's trademarked.
Call Milton.
Oh my god! All right, we'll talk about that later. That's actually a really freaking good idea. But anyway, so what are your other tips?
The next one, I don't have a way to say this that doesn't make me sound like, you know, a grandpa, but you have to be like a go-getter. You're not going to do well in this profession if you are not like actively trying to do well at this profession. I think that like obviously with the whole getting into grad school thing, like you have to be really really active about that and do all of these different things before, and we'll get to that later. But once you're in school, making it known that you're not afraid to ask questions, like I said, speak up in class, volunteer for as many things as you can. When you're in your internships, you know, asking if you can fax something, call a lab to get results, you know, those are things that like make you look really good to your supervisor. And then when you start working, being able to exemplify all of that again and work with the doctors and just really show how much value you have. So being a go-getter, as my grandpa would say.
No, and I think it even goes, like, it goes back to just the idea of being like, well, not being like, but having things on your resume that look really great going into interviews. Like, another reason why a lot of people with some type of job experience, especially in like the sciences or again, like being a genetic counseling assistant or things like that shows a level of self-starting and self-sufficiency that like, okay, that's already one box checked off, but that's something that is so necessary. And sometimes you really can't prove that other than with your experience. So I think that's really, really important to say. But also like going back to also being a go-getter to prove like this is what you want and what you have a passion for, I think it's also really important to think about, you know, soul search, like before you really like, okay, this is what I'm committing to. And I think, you know, working with you at Recombine, this was also something that like I experienced with you and like saw you doing all the time, was like soul searching. Like, is this really what I'm committed to? Like, is this what I really want to do? Like, yes, it is. Like, this experience has validated that for me and, you know, made it more concrete that yes, this is what I'm working for, or et cetera, et cetera. Because going back to, you know, grad school for me, I think it was still a time where genetic counseling was this amorphous thing, and now it's far more fleshed out for the general population. And like, if you're not there for the right reasons, you're immediately, you're not going to be there. So that's really it, all really good points. But yeah, no, go be a go-getter. If that's sounding like a grandpa, then I don't know.
Again, I just don't know that I've ever used like go-getter as like a adjective ever in my personal life besides right now.
I mean, you know, it's like, it is what it is.
I just heard it like secondhand be like, oh yeah, she's a real go-getter.
She's a real go-getter.
So yeah, shout out to my grandpas.
That, but shout out.
But yeah, I don't know if I have two more. I definitely have one more.
Okay, well, that's totally fine.
A big part of being a genetic counselor is the counseling part. So I think there's a lot of people that go into this because they really like genetics, but they don't know how to talk to people. I think having experience with different types of people, however you may get that, is going to be important. And just being able to really understand different people's points of views. I like talking to people. I don't know why, but all of my friends would always tell me all their problems. And so I feel like I had a lot of experience kind of counseling before I even thought of it as counseling. And I think you have to be able to talk to people and also be comfortable with people who have different opinions than you, whether that's doctors or patients. I think a lot of times the most common example that we talk about in class and in life is with pregnancy termination, and whether that's something that you would do for your own pregnancy versus how you think about that for others could be different. And so you might have patients that would not consider for religious reasons, and you need to be okay with that. You could have patients that think that testing is not important because it's God's will that this will happen, and that's very common. You could have patients who their child is affected with a disorder because they have married within their family, because that's part of their culture. There's so many different things that are going to come up in genetics and genetic counseling that are different from the way you might live your life, and being able to be empathetic to those other people's journeys is really important. And being able to talk about these different topics with all different kinds of people really starts with you just being open to having those kind of hard conversations with people. And I've found that there's a couple of people who choose this as a profession that are like not really great at talking to people, and it makes you really good at the genetics part of it, but maybe not the genetic counseling part of it. And, you know, not every genetic counselor is going to be patient facing and be talking with patients on a day-to-day basis. Maybe you want to go to genetic counseling school and then work in a lab. Maybe that's the direction you really want to go to. You want to speak to other genetic counselors. You want to speak to physicians and lab techs and PhDs about genetics, but you're not really interested in talking with patients on a more emotional level. And that's fine. But I think those are things you have to know about yourself going in.
Yeah. And I think because it's going to be a part of your training, if you're that type of person, you also have to be prepared to be very uncomfortable for like a
year and
a half.
Like role plays and standardized patients and all those kinds of things are really uncomfortable, even for people who like counseling and like talking to people. So if you're not that type of person, it's going to be really hard.
Yeah. And I will say, like, I'm more of an introvert than an extrovert. Like, I am totally fine with this whole like staying inside for long periods of time. But like also, like, you do genuinely have to have that interest in other people and other people's views. And you were everything you were saying, I was thinking about one of my classmates who was 100% that person that was like, I'm here because I want to work in genetics, but I 100% don't want to talk to people.
And I think that's a really cool thing. Like, now genetic counseling is something totally different from what it was, you know, 20 years ago, right? Like, there's so many more opportunities for genetic counselors than just being in a clinic talking with patients and their families.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that is far more visible as an option now. And I was just like thinking back to this classmate, like, he was super duper struggling. And I realize now that saying he, if there's anybody that went to school with me, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about, because there was only one other guy in our class. But I also don't think he would have any qualms in agreeing with the fact that he, and I think it was also a cultural thing for him because he was not from the United States. He came in, you know, just not really having all of the tools to speak with, especially certain types of patients, like on a level that would be beneficial to them, or be comfortable for them, and make them trust him to be a part of their care. But yeah, no,
whether it's where you want to end up or not, it's going to be part of your journey.
Yeah. And the other thing that I was going to say was, everyone has their views, totally fine. Like, look at the show, The View. There are opposing views there on purpose to make, you know, dialogues happen, but those dialogues can be really beneficial in a situation like genetic counseling. But you can't let your personal view seep into it, because you are supposed to be an unbiased medical professional in caring for this patient. And I think a really good example of how that's really super cool is one of the places that I think we both observed at in New Jersey when we were thinking about genetic counseling, there's a couple of counselors there. I don't know if they still work there or not, but who are Orthodox or Ashkenazi Jewish, you know, in their own lives. And that spells out a lot about, you know, their day-to-day personal life. But, you know, patients could come in seeing that and expecting one thing, but, you know, they were completely open to talking about whatever, whenever.
Right.
But they did use their own personal views and experiences to their benefit, especially in New Jersey, where there's a high Jewish population, and it was probably more comfortable for some people to speak with a fellow Jewish counselor. But like, you know, there's a difference between, you know, having a certain way of life, having certain views, and letting that get in the way of things. And I think there's plenty of examples of that in the current Americas, if you will. But I will say that in general, that the world of genetic counseling, like the community of genetic counselors, has always felt very welcoming to me. And I think that genetic counselors are bound to end up having very long dialogues about certain things, which is like, okay, I gotta go. Like, my son's leaving in 5 minutes. But also, like, it is cool to have a community where nothing is really, you know, off the table. So that's definitely, going back to what you said, definitely something to think about. Like, if you're not someone who likes to talk to people, or, you know, if you're more specifically what I'm trying to get at, you have certain views or values or morals that you don't think you can get over, maybe genetic counseling isn't for you, because you can't start like preaching the word of yourself to people. Right. That's
and,
not going to work.
You know, the way the world is set up, especially in this country, is there's just certain parts of the country that are also less open to these dialogues, you know, like,
yes.
I'm in the process of looking for jobs. And when I come across a job posting for a Catholic hospital prenatal job, I know that termination is not something I'm going to be able to discuss with my patients. I think some places say you can't bring it up unless the patient brings it up, because it upsets them or whatever their reasoning is. And I know that those are not places where I want to be. However, if you align yourself with those views, maybe you work there instead of, you know, a inner city hospital. I think you have to be open that there are different viewpoints out there. You know, you're not making decisions for your patients. You're helping them make their own decisions. And so, yeah.
I mean, that's really it. Yeah. No. And that's again, like the soul searching part of like, is this what I want to do with my life? That's definitely something to take into account. Like before you jump to this pool, you 100% have to make sure that like this is something that you can navigate long term, because that's really important part of what we do. So if you don't have a fifth one, I think I have a fifth one from just us talking over the course of this week. Yeah. so it's kind of a joke, but it's like really important to have smart footwear.
Oh my god, yes.
And yeah, and in a closet full of cardigans, because like funny haha, but this is even something that happens at like the NSGC conference every year. Like it's a sea of like flesh tone, like to like nature
tone. If you've ever
cardigans.
Opened up a J. Crew catalog,
yes, 100%. Some people prefer the cardigans with buttons. Some prefer the really long ones that have like the flaps that flow. I'm really privy to like navy blue.
That one that you have, that's like kind of like a grandpa sweater, and it's just. Yes.
Exactly. Yes. That's like my OG, like forever ride or die genetic counseling cardigan. I mean, nowadays I'm doing a lot more work in my pajamas because I don't have to see anybody face to face. But that's also like my job as a whole now. So, you know, I dress up when I have to. But yeah, you need to have a couple cardigans. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. It doesn't matter how you identify. You need a couple cardigans. You need that comfortable footwear because you're going to be walking. At some times you might be running around hospital. And so going back to the flexible thing, you should also be physically flexible because sometimes you have to jam a lot of people into a small room for a session because, you know, there might be the lady that comes by herself for a session, but then there's also that person that brings like their whole extended family for support, which is completely understandable depending upon what you're talking about. But like, you can only fit so many people into a room. So yeah, have cardigans and be flexible, and maybe do some like cardio every once in a while.
Yeah, it's a little get in a good sleep schedule before going to GC school. It's definitely not as intense as like a medical school where you're going to be put on a overnight 24-hour shift at a hospital as part of your training, you've got to be able to juggle. I mean,
yeah, like it's not Grey's Anatomy, but I'm also like
really mad that Grey's Anatomy has not had a genetic counselor character yet. I'm like hoping for like a hot dude genetic counselor.
Well, that would a hot gay dude genetic counselor. That would hit all of like the all of the bells, not just for me, but like, oh snap. And like maybe he's also like biracial or something. It would be like, yeah, who is this person?
I'm here for it.
I'll
call up Shonda and be like, listen.
Hey Shonda. I don't know if you know about genetic counseling, but here's why you should. I mean, I haven't watched Grey's Anatomy and like I can't even tell you. Like I think I stopped watching it like season 6 or something like that. So I have no idea what the heck is going on. But I'm watching like Arthur and I are going through Bones right now.
I will say Grey's has a lot of new like LGBTQ characters and scenarios going on in the last couple seasons, which is nice to see.
I do enjoy that. But yeah, I mean, so because Bones is dealing with like skeletal remains a lot of the times because it's Bones, they do integrate genetic conditions like a lot of times, like and well, yeah, like accurately is more so the word. I hate, and I feel like we've talked about this before, like not just genetics wise, but like prenatal wise, where like the baby comes out clean from like mom's undercarriage, or I can't think of a good example of when like there's been a completely inaccurate depiction of a genetic disorder, but like in general, a lot of times they'll have people who are supposed to have like cystic fibrosis or something. And, you know, they're just, like, glamorous and, like, the vision of, like, fresh and dewy. And it's, like, I'm sorry. If this is a woman with cystic fibrosis in, like, her mid-20s, she's not going to look fresh and dewy.
Although now with all the new drugs, maybe.
Yeah, you never know. Like, depending upon what types of mutations she has, maybe she could look fresh and dewy.
Yeah, I think that the one thing that strikes me as like not being displayed properly is anytime that they're doing like any kind of genetic testing and it's like comes back same day.
Oh yeah. Or like, yeah, like any crime show and it's like,
we got a match.
We got a partial fingerprint. And then, we also got one piece of like hair from somewhere and we compared it to this database that doesn't exist and all the results came back in 20 minutes. Yeah, that's not enough
DNA. You need to like PCR that for hours. Yeah.
You need to do something. You're going to be like, you're going to be PCRing. You're going to be like doing some next generation sequencing. You're going to be doing something because one piece of hair alone does not does not make a conviction, like, you know. And I think, like, across the board, that's a problem with a lot of crime shows. But also, if they made it accurate, it would be like a case would go on for like three episodes, because they'd have to send out for the results and it would come back.
Like, I mean, in terms of that whole like balancing act, I mean, in grad school, you're right now, I'm, you know, I just handed in my thesis. Thank goodness. So, you know, you're balancing class, you're balancing thesis, you're balancing your internship, and then you also have like your own life, and things don't just stop because you're in grad school, clearly. And then beyond that, you know, once it gets to the end and you're looking for jobs and you're interviewing, you're balancing a lot of stuff. So that type A personality, make yourself a spreadsheet, keep your life organized, get a cute planner.
Yes, these are all, yes, very, very valuable things. And all things that I feel like we've all probably done. And I can say for certain all my classmates did, because they would show me their spreadsheets like on a daily basis. But yeah, no, it's really important to keep organized, because there's a lot of things going on. And I'm just thinking, like, if Grey's Anatomy is med school, like, what is it? Like, I feel like genetic counseling grad school is kind of like, I don't want to say a real world road rules challenge, but I also can't think of anything else. It's just, it's a lot. It's a lot at once. And not that med school isn't a lot at once, but like, it's a lot of only semi-related things all at once that are all parts of an ultimate goal. But you're all over the place.
It's packed into 2 years, and it's, I mean, not even, it's like a year and a half, and it's all goes by very quickly. I mean, your thesis project, like at most you'll have like a full year to work on it, but with like actually doing a proposal, getting IRB approval and all that stuff, like you're coming down on like a good 6 months of research. Like, that's not a lot.
Yeah, it's not the time to procrastinate, ultimately. Like if you're like, you know what, I really can't deal with this, I'll do it tomorrow. Make sure you do it tomorrow. Like, don't
wait any longer. Yeah, and like, I'm the queen of doing things at the last minute, and I've survived, but it's tough.
Yeah, no, and I am also the queen of doing things at last minute. Always. Always and forever, still now even. But yeah, and you know, some people work really well under pressure, but you're already under pressure, I think is my point. So like, if you're the person that works really, really well under pressure, then sure, wait till the last minute. That's kind of how I did everything and I was fine. But if you are like 100% type A personality, and the thought of this in general is already too much for you, don't procrastinate. Like, make your spreadsheet, get everything done, blah 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 blah. It's a blur, and it's fun, but it's also like, what the heck is going on, and what is my life, and like, have I made a full meal like ever in the last year and a half? And I remember eating a lot of Wendy's apple pecan chicken salads in grad school, because I was just like, I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, my go-to meal right now is a Wawa soft pretzel and a giant cup of coffee.
I mean, that, yeah. Wawa in general, like, I'm very envious of the fact that you have Wawa. Yeah, no, if there was a Wawa on Staten Island, I would be there. I mean, not right now, but I would be there all the time otherwise, because All of their tea beverages are fantastic. Like, they're half and half, like lemonade.
Ooh, I just got a grade back. I got 20 out of 20.
Oh. Live on the scene, everyone. Casey is doing well in grad school. But yeah, so those were all the questions that I had to go through. I feel like we hit upon some really great things for people to think about if they're considering becoming a genetic counselor. But now, you know, just to kind of give everybody a roadmap, I figured we'd go through, like, what do you actually have to literally do?
So, obviously, so, we're speaking to, you know, how things work in the U.S. of A.
Correct. But yes. Yes.
I think that things – so, the first time I applied and when you applied, it was just the general application process. People reach out to you if you're accepted, and then you have to make a decision. And the second time I applied, mm-hmm. things were very different. It was the first year that they're doing this match program. So that's the way it's done now, is kind of like for med students in their residency, you interview everywhere that you get an interview, and then you have to rank them. And so it adds this like weird game into the process.
Yeah, I don't think I would have done well with that, because it would have been like, if I really want to go here, do I want them to know that they're my first pick? Like, should I give them some air of disinterest, or like, some, like, I would have been so completely and utterly like a ball of nerves. But that's definitely very new. Like, so I guess it's new in the last 2 years.
Yeah, so the people that were applying for the class, or applying to start fall 2018, that was the first match. So I think they've done it. This will be the third year.
Yeah. And as we touched upon earlier, I think that, you know, a lot of programs are opening up more slots and mm-hmm. are making their classes larger. But historically, genetic counseling programs, class sizes are very small on purpose, because you get a lot more individual interaction with your professors and in training.
It has a lot to do with those, and especially your internships. Like, if you're in a place where there's no genetic counselors, they're not going to have enough people to be supervisors.
Right. Yeah. So definitely the programs, like especially here on the East Coast in New York and Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and a little bit in New Jersey, you know, their class sizes are a little bit larger than they have been historically. Like, I graduated with, I think it was like 13 full-time students and then 2 or 3 part-time students. But at the time, like that 17-ish people, we were the largest graduating class ever from Sarah Lawrence College. And then the next first year class after that was like 21 students. And, you know, I don't expect anybody to know the specifics of the Sarah Lawrence program, but just to kind of like put things into perspective, the vast majority of your academic classes happen in this rather small, like, whiteboard classroom that is in the basement of one of the graduate school buildings. And it really only holds like tops, like 15-ish people plus a professor. So I was just like, how are they even fitting 20 some odd people in this room? You know? Like, that's kind of like, there's been this rapid growth, which is really fantastic. But now there has to be all this catch up with the programs to make sure that they even have the, you know, infrastructure to handle more students. So probably with a lot of the programs, the class sizes are still going to remain pretty small. And that's probably somewhere between like some programs even only take like 4 students per year. But I would say on average, like a more typical size is somewhere between like 8 and 10 right now. And then it's a little bit larger depending upon where there might be more availability for those internships, like, and mm-hmm. especially in our area of the country where we are, like, there's like some, as long as you have a car, somebody from the Sarah Lawrence program in upstate New York, well, it's not really it's New York City. Yeah. It's New York City. Let's just say New York. Like, if somebody had a car, they could technically mm-hmm. drive to Connecticut or Pennsylvania. That would be
really gross for them as an intern, but they could do it. But like now with New York City, like all the major hospitals have cancer centers, prenatal centers, you know, that's the word I was looking for. Pediatric centers.
Yeah.
Like you're not hurting.
And I know a lot of programs are doing,
but also
like allowing for telegenetics rotations and things like that too.
Right. Yeah. And like, yeah, Cooper Surgical, we definitely have students first year and second year that come to us for internships. But obviously it's all telegenetics. And I guess you would know because you were technically our intern. but yeah, so in terms of like what you're going into, that's kind of the lay of the land. But you know, it's this 2-year program. I believe it's pretty standard at this point that between your 2 years, you have a longer summer internship than your 3 smaller internships during the actual academic years. And that's kind of like your first like real world job experience and where you're going to get a lot of your cases for your logbook, which you need
for boards.
To eventually exactly go
and I think at Arcadia all 4 exam. Of our internships are pretty much the same length. Like you need to get 20 days of experience. But once you're back in school, you might be going less frequently. Or now if we were able to do our last rotation, we only have class 1 day a week. So we actually have 4 days to go to an internship. So you're going more frequently just over a shorter period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're going to want to get cases. Typically how this works when there's not a global pandemic is you would have internships in the different specialties. So you would have a peds rotation, prenatal rotation, cancer rotation. You might have a telegenetics rotation nowadays. In some cases, again, depending upon where you are, you might have the opportunity to work with someone in a specialty clinic, like a cardiac clinic or a neuro clinic, or a clinic that deals with a specific set of diseases, like a cystic fibrosis clinic, a cystic fibrosis clinic, or like a clinic that may deal with specifically metabolic disorders, and there's a medical geneticist there who specializes in metabolic
diseases. Yeah, so like for an example, the rotations I did, my first one was in a mitochondrial genetics clinic, which is extremely specialized.
That sounds super cool.
The next one I did was a pediatric rotation, but I was with a counselor who mainly worked with skeletal dysplasias. Then I did my telegenetics with Cooper. And then for my full internships, I did a prenatal clinic, which was a general prenatal clinic, not too many high-risk patients. Then I did a cancer rotation, and it was adult cancer. And then I did a high-risk prenatal working with the Center for Fetal Diagnosis and Treatment at CHOP, where we saw only high risk. And my fourth rotation would have been pediatric cardiology. So you can get very specialized if you're in a city and in somewhere where there are so many different clinics available to you.
Yeah. And that's definitely something to take into account when you're thinking about what programs that you want to apply to. But like, I'm just thinking about like being in a cardiac clinic in general sounds super fascinating to me. And like the other thing that I always say is like, I can know the generals about, you know, X, Y, or Z syndrome, like, you know, in the context of cardiac, like it might be like long QT. I think I've mentioned long QT before in a previous episode, or like, you know,
hypertrophic.
What's it called?
Yeah.
Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, that one. But like, I might know the genes that cause it most commonly. I might know the generals of it. Like, I do know some people who have long QT specifically and how that affects their lives. And I actually had a classmate that has long QT, and she's a dancer, which doesn't make much sense, but she's a gorgeous, beautiful, like, bohemian, you know, Manhattanite woman. You know, there's, but like the very specifics of it and like how someone who deals with that on a daily basis explains something to a patient, those are the things that fascinate me the most, because like, you know, that they've come up with their own tips and tricks and outlines that work best for them. And that's the type of stuff that's super fascinating for when somebody hyper specializes like that, like how much detail there really is to think about and to know, and all of the things to juggle for that specific patient type to make sure that their care is the best. Like, there's certainly things that like I wouldn't have, like, would not even be on the table for me with anything outside of reproductive genetics. Like, even with cancer, where like typically most genetic counselors are most familiar with prenatal and cancer, like I wouldn't, like, I've never ordered a panel test before, because when I was still in school, it was like single gene tests still. And now there's these huge panels, and I'm sure the counseling has changed dramatically because of that. Because even working in prenatal, when we had the advent of NIPT, counseling had to change significantly. When microarrays got better resolution for prenatal tests, like with an amnio sample or CVS sample, like, again, we had to talk about what are the new potentials that we might find. Like, could we find on paternity, could we find consanguinity because of this, and things like that, and having to go through all of the potentials, like, are you sure you want to order this test because this thing might come up, and then we don't want to have a Lori situation.
Honestly, like,
on
the different specialties, that's the cool thing about going into genetic counseling, is you don't have to like pick and stick. You can, if you want to work in prenatal for a little bit and then work in cancer, that's fine. If you feel like you're qualified and you want to jump around, or maybe you want to work in peds, but you start off in a neuro peds job dealing with children with epilepsy syndromes, and then you want to do pediatric cardiology, there's no rules saying you have to stay in one specialty, unlike being a doctor, where they tend to pick a specialty and stay there.
It's probably important
and I think
to do that.
That's the really cool part of being a genetic counselor, is that you get all these experiences during school. And then once you get your first job, you test it out. If it's not for you, you find something else.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, going back to something I said before about, you know, genetic counseling in general, is that our skill set is very easily extrapolated to a lot of different settings. And I think that's where, you know, the flexibility comes in long-term in your career, where, you know, you can say, all right, well, you know what, I've worked in clinical care for a long while now. I think I want the challenge of working for a laboratory or a clinic or X, Y, or Z. And while there certainly will be a learning curve for you, nothing is really ever a super duper deal breaker.
I remember when, like, I was first thinking about genetic counseling as a profession, was when I was applying to undergraduate programs. And I remember my dad saying to me that he thinks that I chose a good path because I'll never be the stupidest person in the room. And I think what he meant by that is that the world of genetics is so quickly changing. We're learning new things every single day.
Yes.
So someone's always going to need to be brought up to speed. And that's why there are so many different specialties, because we really need as many people in each specialty as possible to keep everyone else on their toes.
It is,
so I
really
guess
true,
back
though.
To why do I want to be a genetic counselor? Yeah, I mean, like, I don't want to be the stupidest person in the room.
There we go. That's the tagline for this episode. How do I not become the stupidest person in the room? There we go. That, no, but I mean, yeah. Yeah. Yes. That bend and CRISPR hashtag. Let's get that trending. Everyone would be like, what is going on? It's Imagine if that hashtag trended. yeah, it's very doubtful, but in these end times, like, who knows what's going on? But yeah, no, I feel like genetic counseling is very much like the old tagline for Outback Steakhouse, where it's like, no rules, just right, or whatever. Because you really, you can carve out your own path. And the, yeah, it's just like the world kind of becomes your oyster once you, and this is going to sound really ridiculous and cheesy, but like once you own your power and your knowledge and your skill set, like there really isn't much stopping you if you want to pursue something different other than like you saying you want to do it. Because there's still so much to learn, you know, like unless you work for a hospital that's really going to be like, no, this is your job and that's all you can do. Like doing research, collaborating with other counselors and doctors, mm-hmm. like all of that is only helping us as a whole, like as a career. So, yeah, just like do you and.
But yeah, and like back yeah, to, you know, how do you become. I think so. Right. Before you even apply to these programs, things that are helpful are having some kind of work experience, whether that's an, you know, internship you had in undergrad, working with a professor on their research, volunteering for a crisis hotline or somewhere where you're going to get counseling experience. Shadowing genetic counselors, although it's becoming harder now because HIPAA laws are preventing some students from finding shadowing opportunities. But if you can get them, take them. And, you know, just really getting as many things on your resume that show that this is something that you're interested in. You'll have to take the GREs for most programs. There are some that you don't have to, but most of them want to see that you, again, can math and write. And I think in terms of applying, I mean, most of them have a December 31st or like a January 15th deadline. So that's kind of the timeline. There's no like common application for graduate school, which is annoying, but most of them will be asking you the same questions. You'll have to do like a personal statement why you want to be a genetic counselor. You can steal my answer, but just know that everyone else might also steal my answer. So come up with something that has meaning to you.
Yeah. And if you're going to steal it, like run it through like some type of, you know, program first, because everybody's going to be like, I don't know, this sounds a lot like Casey Marks' answer. So,
and I think that, you know, the questions they ask are really just trying to get to know you as a person and why you want to be a genetic counselor. So it shouldn't be a hard question for you to answer. If this is truly what you want to do, you should have an answer for that question. And then programs will generally contact you in like early to late February, if they want to interview with you. And I think that if you get interviews at these programs, it's a really good sign. It means that they think that you have what it takes, and now they're really just narrowing it down. If you don't get any interviews, I think that's a good time to kind of look at your experience. And And once interviews are all said and done, you can contact the program and say, hey, what was my resume missing? What didn't I have that you are looking for? But if you get an interview, that's a really good sign. It shows you have what it takes. And you'll do your interviews with the program.
Emily and Erica are driving through Dunkin' Donuts. Do you want coffee or tea?
I'm sorry?
Emily and Erica are bringing us bagels, but they're going to Dunkin' Donuts first. Do you want coffee or tea?
I do not.
Okay. No, he's good.
Oh my gosh. So, listeners, just like last episode, my husband barged into the room. He's gone already.
I'm sorry. Did you not want the offer of free coffee or tea and bagels?
No, that's very lovely of our friends offering that they're going through a drive-thru in these end times and they want to come give us coffee, but you knew I was recording. But Casey says hi.
Edit me out.
I'm not editing you out. I'm not doing it. But do you say hi back to Casey? Or...
I praise Casey on a daily basis.
Okay. All right. There we go. This is the content you came here for, people.
But yeah, so then
okay, but
you
yeah.
will interview at all these places, and then this is where the match kind of gets weird, is you then, after interviewing, uh-huh. just have to pick. You essentially have to, everywhere right. you interview yeah. at, you mean... can rank them. So if you interview at five places, you can rank all five of those programs. You also have the option, if you interviewed somewhere and you were like, this is not for me, you don't have to rank them. So you can only rank, you know, three of the five if you want. But that's not it. It gets more complicated. Each program may have multiple tracks that you can rank. So for example, when I was applying, mm-hmm. Arcadia had a track for just general admission. They had a track where you could rank admission plus a scholarship. They had a track where you could rank admission plus a graduate assistantship within the program. And then I think there was a fourth one for minorities trying to increase the diversity of genetic counselors. So if you were of a minority, you could apply for that track as well. And so I had to end up ranking, you know, of the three programs I applied to, I must have ended up ranking like six or eight different tracks. So then it comes down to, do I want to rank this program first, just generally without the scholarship, because I want to go here no matter what, and I'm scared that if I say I'll only go here with a scholarship, then I might miss my chance. But they do that for people who maybe mm-hmm. wouldn't be able to afford to go to that program without a scholarship. So they can choose to only rank the scholarship tracks if that's something that they really need for their education. And so it's very complicated. It's something that will hopefully be described well to you if you get to that step of the process. And just remember, the programs are also, this is new for them. It'll only be like the fourth time that they've done it the next time around. So everyone's still learning. But essentially, you rank all the programs, you click a button, you submit your rankings, and the programs are doing the same thing. They're ranking all the people that they interviewed. So let's say they interviewed 80 people. They might only rank 40 with the hopes of accepting 16. So it's a numbers game. It's kind mm-hmm. of a scary process. Yeah. But the idea of it is that you're going to get matched with the program that wants you and you want them. And it takes a lot of the waiting and the shuffle of the original way they did it off the table.
Oh yeah, there was, yeah, even in my year there was like plenty of drama. It was like I remember there was like mm-hmm. Like we had one slot left open in our class somehow, and then it was like does anybody have a student that they want to like throw our way? It was so weird. It was like yeah. talking
and like
about
when
people,
I first
like,
applied, very... I only applied to two programs and I was waitlisted at both of them. So it was like a really stressful time waiting to see mm-hmm. if I could be an extra person to throw their way.
Right. And like, I totally understand why they're doing this new system, and hopefully yeah. it'll just get completely ironed out in the next couple of go arounds, and then and I'm sure it will,
yeah.
because genetic counselors are, again, hashtag type A personalities. yeah, be flexible and bend and CRISPR And so then you finally get into school. You have your 2 years of schooling. You know, you have your internships. You do your thesis. You collect your core. Yeah. And then you graduate. And now it's like, uh-oh, you got to take your board exam. And I don't even want to get into that. I honestly feel like there could be a mini episode on the board exam itself. It has evolved very much so in the last couple of years. There's typically the core questions that you actually have to answer. And then there's typically a set of questions that are like test questions where they're looking to see if enough people can accurately answer them to put them onto the next year's version of the test, or if, you know, some of these have completely failed or things like that. And again, you're going to fail. There's going to be failures along the way. I failed the board exam the first time by 1 point, and it was horrible. But then I didn't the second time. And I think ultimately the reason I didn't fail it the second time was because when I went back, I got a lot more support from my community of fellow students and counselors than I looked for the first time around. And also from my husband, who was my then boyfriend, who made me lots of delicious food while I studied for it. But there's a lot of resources available for counseling students. There's like an official study course and things like that. But then like also talk to, especially if you have a job right out of the gate from graduate school, talk to your colleagues, because they probably have study materials that they will be very willing to lend you. But I am seeing right now we have like 8 minutes left available on this recording. So, I mean, ultimately, I feel like that kind of brings us to the end of the cycle. You take your board exam. You get certified. Yeah. You get all those letters at the end of your name. And now you're at sometimes MS, you get an L. CGC. Sometimes you get an L. According to the ABGC, they want people to, even if they're licensed, keep the CGC, because licensing is like essentially assumed if you're working in a state that has licensure that you're licensed there. But I'm sure there's still going to be plenty of people that have an L CGC. But yeah, so that is that. That's, in a nutshell, a very large nutshell, how you become a genetic counselor. And this has been an extremely enjoyable conversation. I'm so glad that we got to do this, because we haven't even really talked in a while anyway, because life is crazy and hashtag Corona and all the things. But you're like about to get your life back, and almost and you're applying for jobs, and I'm super excited for you.
It's exciting and nerve-wracking, and it feels like that same, you know, applying to GC school process all over again. But
yeah, it's like you're selling yourself all over again,
right? Not and like
why should you like me, why should you give me money? Yeah, no, right. Because except now it's like, why should you pay me a salary? Not like, why should you accept me to this program? But you know, you got your shit together. You're going to do the thing. This global pandemic can't keep you down.
Inside, but it can't keep me down.
So that is that. So yes, it can keep you inside, but it can't keep you down. That is 100% accurate. So
thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. This has been really fun. I'm really glad you were my first guest, because it was super great. And I hope this does answer a lot of the questions that I've been getting through Instagram about, you know, I'm thinking of becoming a genetic counselor. What do I do? Blah, 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 blah. Certainly, as I've said, if there's any questions that aren't covered by the topic of an episode, shoot me an email or an Instagram DM, or I'm also on Twitter now, so you could DM me on Twitter as well. But you know, we're here to answer your questions and demystify the world of genetic counseling, so that's what we'll keep on doing. And obviously you're welcome back whenever you want. And we can tell the children of the world about what we do and why we like it. And Yeah, so you can follow Gene Therapy Podcast on Instagram at Gene Therapy Pod, and I'm also on Twitter as Gene Therapy Pod. So go follow us there. Also, give us a rating and a like on all the listening applications. And if you want to email me, you can email me at genetherapypodcast@gmail.com.
Yay.
Casey, I'm really excited for you to graduate. I'm really excited for you to tell
I'll
me
that you
have
a job. Yeah, I'll come back and I'll do a how to get a job. Soon,
hopefully. Exactly. Yeah. Honestly, that would be useful to students. You know, very timely.
I have a job and
I have
you
a
can
job
too.
And you don't. How do you get one too? Yes. Ha 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 ha. But also not. Okay. I'm going to cut myself off because I always can ramble on forever. That's the only thing I'm really bad at. But thank you so much for coming on this Sunday morning and discussing all of the genetic counseling school things with me. Have a lovely rest of your Sunday inside with your with your really gorgeous rescue dog that I'm jealous of. And we will talk very soon. Okay. Alrighty, everyone. I guess that's that. So this has been episode 3 of Gene Therapy.
Bye, everyone.
And goodbye.
's been Gene Therapy with Nick Charles. Please note that while I am a medical professional, any information discussed in this podcast does not constitute actionable medical advice. If you feel genetic counseling is appropriate for you, visit nsgc.org to find a genetic counselor practicing in your area. And don't forget to comment, rate, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Bye for now.